Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of From My Point of View. Quite an eventful Tuesday morning we've had here. Saquon Barkley, Jaylen Brown, and then their two contracts, and then the most shocking of everything, and I'm glad I'm able to say this in a more casual manner, I guess, because he's okay, but Bronny James had he suffered from a cardiac arrest, and I can't imagine he's been at USC for more than like a few weeks. High-level programs like USC basketball and the like, you know, college basketball doesn't start for another several months, but they're always just in there before everyone else in their class and all that, practicing as a team, running drills and all that, and he collapsed running a drill at USC and suffered cardiac arrest. He is now out of the ICU. I think they said this happened yesterday. So they were waiting for him to, like, I guess, shockingly enough, pull through and be okay before they released any sort of statement or anything like that. And now he's out of the ICU, so he is okay. But, oh my God, what a scary event for the James family. We'll talk about that first because it is definitely the most heavy, the heaviest of topics, like by far, just because this is, we're talking about sports and movies today, and that's a pretty heavy topic to talk about. So we'll start there, and then we'll get into Jaylen Brown's contract, Saquon Barkley's contract, the MLB 2024 Hall of Fame ballots, which I wrote about for Animal House yesterday, but I will talk about on the podcast today. And then, of course, Barbenheimer, which I got to go see both movies. I did not see them on the same day. I saw Oppenheimer Sunday night, and I saw Barbie Monday night. Both really enjoyable films, in my opinion. So let's dive in to today's topics. We are going to start with Bronny James. So Shams, he tweeted this at 10:30 in the morning. USC All-American Bronny James collapsed on the court Monday and had a cardiac arrest. He was taken to the hospital, is now in stable condition, no longer in the ICU. This is the statement from the James family, PR manager, whatever it is. Yesterday, while practicing, Bronny James suffered a cardiac arrest. Medical staff was able to treat Bronny and take him to the hospital. He is now in stable condition and no longer in ICU. We ask for respect and privacy for the James family, and we will update media when there is more information. LeBron and Savannah wish to publicly send their deepest thanks and appreciation to the USC medical and athletic staff for their incredible work and dedication to the safety of their athletes. I mean, first and foremost, I'm glad he's okay, of course. Secondly, LeBron and his wife, Savannah, and their other two kids, Bryce and Zuri, what an absolute nightmare scenario they must have been going through. Unfortunately, speaking from firsthand experience, it is nothing you ever want to be a part of, nothing that I would ever wish on anybody ever. And, you know, you could say whatever you want about LeBron competitively and as a basketball player. You can have your opinions about him, whatever they may be. But objectively, as a father and a husband and just a human being, LeBron James is top tier. He is an exceptional father who loves and supports his kids constantly. He continuously gives back to his community, specifically in Akron. He is essentially running that city by building a school, a community center, a place for affordable housing for low-income families, providing health insurance to people, literally providing health insurance to people. It is the most insane thing ever, what LeBron has done for that community where he is from, and just in general, his charitable contributions and stuff. Like, he is an exceptional human being and an exceptional father. So I'm glad that life didn't punish him for some reason, you know? So I'm so glad that he and Savannah, of course, his wife, and their two other children. I can exactly imagine what was running through their minds, but it is like, I'm glad they didn't have to see that come to fruition. They were able to avoid this catastrophic event from the family, and everyone's okay. And everyone's going to be okay. I'm glad that that is the case. As someone who watches sports and appreciates sports, there is clearly a cool down period for Bronny James. No one is going to be rushing him back to play basketball anytime soon. But it does bear the question, is he going to play basketball ever again? Like, this is not just some, you know, he passed out from exhaustion or something like that. And, you know, there's medically nothing wrong with him other than he was just run down. This is a real medical problem. A cardiac arrest is no small joke. Was this brought on from prolonged exhaustion? I was watching the news and there was a couple people, you know, they bring on these doctor correspondents when things like this happen. And the question was posed, you know, this is an 18-year-old kid, super athletic, conditioned to the 1% of human beings on the planet, basically, right? How can this happen? How can an 18-year-old kid have a cardiac arrest? And the doctor posed the question that the heart, like any other muscle, can exhibit exhaustion. You know, there might not be any real answer unless there is a very specific medical issue, in which case that would be like an irregular heartbeat or some other type of defect that was unbeknownst to Bronny and his family that had now just manifested themselves into this. I don't know if that's the case, but a hypothetical that he posed was, since the heart is a muscle just like everything else, it could have been literally from exhaustion. And you got to think, maybe someone at Bronny's age, especially in the world of basketball today, that might be possible. This kid is basically playing basketball 300 days a year. Maybe he is tired. Maybe that is a reason why he suffered from a cardiac arrest like this. Who knows? I remember Keontae Johnson, who was on that this Kansas State team that performed really well in March Madness this year. They went all the way to the Elite Eight or the Final Four. And he was at Florida a couple years ago, and he collapsed on the court mid-game. And it took him like 2 whole years to finally like recover and condition his body and be healthy to return to playing high-level basketball. I don't know if the severity with Bronny is necessarily the same, but regardless of if there is any real medical condition, or is this because it was like a freak accident and he overexhausted himself and his heart literally gave out because he overused himself. There's no rushing him back. Like, I already said it in the morning when I saw it to my friends, like, I would be shocked if he played basketball this year. Shocked. I mean, right now, I don't think anyone's really thinking that in that family. Like, I'm thinking it, and I'm sure other people are, but no one in that immediate family. Bronny's not thinking it. You know, his dad's not thinking it. Whatever agents they have or anything like that, no one is thinking about, well, what does this do to Bronny's chances of playing in the NBA? I don't really think that's anything that has crossed their mind. Maybe in a couple weeks it will. When he's out of the hospital, it will, but right now it's not. But for me, it is, just because I'm not, you know, directly involved with that situation. But, for me and a lot of other people who were excited to see Bronny and excited to see his career progress, that is something that you got to think about. should this, not even can, should this kid play basketball again? That is a huge question that is going to have to be posed to him in the near future. Because this, again, this wasn't just like some freak thing where he was tired and lost consciousness because he was dehydrated or some other, you know, fluke thing like that. This was a real medical emergency for the most crucial part of your body, which is the heart, right? This isn't anything else. It's very, very, very scary stuff. And I'm just, all these questions, I'm sure, will be publicized in the coming weeks and maybe the next few months, leading all the way up to the beginning of college basketball. But right now, we just wait for Bronny to be officially discharged from the hospital and see what other information comes from his, you know, medical examination and whatnot. But I'm glad he's okay. And I'm glad that the James family is okay and everything is fine, because, you know, he, at the end of the day, he's an 18-year-old kid, right? So never want anything bad to happen to those kind of young kids, you know? Some basketball news that you're allowed to have an opinion on. You know, Bronny was basically just news, but opinionated news. Jaylen Brown, an outrageous contract. The Boston Celtics agreed to a 5-year, $304 million Supermax contract extension, which is now the richest deal in NBA history. It boils down to just under a sliver under $61 million per year. Just the most indescribable amount of money coming out right now. And you still talk about baseball money, because baseball money is real. Baseball money is like that longevity money, right? Like 8, 9, 10-year contracts for hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars. Whereas basketball is approaching that in shorter length contracts. These guys are making, you know, there's guys in the MLB who are on $300+ million deals, but those are stretched out over 8, 9, 10 years. Whereas Jaylen Brown is now making $304 million in 5 years. And for context, in 2016, and I'm not sure how many people actually know this because it feels like an obscure stat, but in 2016, Mike Conley Jr., the Grizzlies point guard at the time, signed a 5-year, $153 million contract. That was, at the time in 2016, the richest contract in NBA history. And now in 2023, 7 years later, Jaylen Brown signed a 5-year, $304 million contract, basically doubled the contract of Mike Conley Jr., which is like, it's just outrageous. Like, at the, and you know there's going to be another salary cap jump too, which is like, if there is another one, is Luka going to be making like $80 million a year? I don't really, it's nuts, man. It's nuts. There's no telling where these contracts go now to guys who are better than Jaylen Brown, because Jaylen Brown is not the best player in the NBA. Like, if Jaylen Brown was the best NBA player in the NBA and this is the contract he got, then that's the ceiling. That's it. Like, that is like, this is the best player getting the most money. Everyone else is lesser than and will therefore make less. But that's just not the case. Jaylen Brown is like, I think he's definitely a top 20 player in the NBA. But even then, I'm sure some sticklers, like, you can go out there and argue if he actually is or not. But regardless, he's not top 10. He's certainly not top 5. So to be making the most money in the NBA, now this just opens up the floodgates to, like, what are some of these other dudes who are top 10, top 5 players in the league? What are they going to start making in a few years? You know, what does that look like? So just a completely outrageous contract. for the Celtics to give Jaylen Brown. You know, I was manifesting Jaylen Brown to the Knicks. That's obviously dead. But wow, like what? Just a crazy contract. And if you're the Celtics, you had to make this deal. I don't know if you had to make this deal specifically with that much money, but I guess you did because that's what Jaylen Brown wanted. And what are you going to do? Say no. You need your championship window to be open. They wanted to solidify this core that they have of basically the core that they have is Tatum and Brown. They want those two guys there and everything else. Just figure it out. But they locked in. They're locked in. So now you're paying everybody a lot of money. And your championship window is these next 4 to 6 years, I'm going to say. Because Jaylen Brown, this extension doesn't kick in until after next year. Because he still has a year left on his contract here. And then after that, the 5-year extension kicks in. So he's locked in for 6 more seasons. This is it. This is it. Insanity, man. Honestly, it really is insanity. So there you go. NBA money is becoming the most lucrative. It's the most lucrative sport, probably. Just on average, definitely the most lucrative. Even vet minimums, you're making like a couple mil a year now, I think, in the NBA. Truly incredible. Another contract. The second contract, the one that I'm more happy about directly, is that Saquon Barkley signed a new 1-year deal. It's different than the salary cap. It's different than the franchise tag, I should say. But he has today reported to training camp for the first day. And I'm very, very happy for Saquon Barkley. This comes off the heels. I'm sure he kind of pissed a lot of people off. I'm not going to lie to you. Because there were some running backs that held a meeting, led by, I think, Austin Eckler and Nick Chubb. Nick Chubb just straight up speaking facts to the media the other day where he said, running back is the only position where you can have a record-breaking season. You know, you can rush for over 2,000 yards. You can score however many touchdowns you want. The best year of your career. You can have the best year of any running back ever. And then the following season, teams will look at you like you're somehow worse because of all the workload you had in the previous season. So you now, after performing at an all-time height, are now seen as lesser because of it, which is 100% factual. There was no lies being told by Nick Chubb. That is 100% accurate in today's market and how franchises and GMs see running backs. It's the truth, and it's an unfortunate truth. But a lot of these running backs were really like coming together. Like, you know, Jacobs didn't get a deal. Saquon didn't get a deal. Eckler's been wanting a deal. He's not on a franchise tag or anything, but he wanted a new deal, and the Chargers basically laughed in his face. You know, Nick Chubb, Derrick Henry, Christian McCaffrey, these are all guys I talked about last week that were all on record being like, this is ridiculous that these guys didn't get any deals done. So they came together and kind of talked about how can we try and fix this. I didn't think about it at the time when I was talking last week, but I think the most logical fix would be to eliminate the use of franchise tags on running backs. It is the most volatile position. Or, I mean, if you want to be even Steven, eliminate the franchise tag altogether. Just do away with it and get rid of it. Because in that case, then you're chilling. I mean, you know, the franchise tag has been used in other ways. I think Kirk Cousins was tagged like 3 separate years in a row. Because he got tagged in, I think, Washington, and then got traded to Minnesota, where he then also got tagged. It was some weird thing like that. But he had been tagged multiple times and made a lot of money off of it. And he's a QB, so his career ages well. If you're going to tag, like, a running back or an offensive lineman or a defensive lineman, that's different, too. I think the clean-cut, fair way to deal with it is just get rid of the franchise tag. And I don't really think it affects football that much. I think it's a silly rule used on, at least in now, today's game, used on a volatile position to chew up and spit out running backs. And it's not really fair to them at all. So just get rid of the franchise tag is probably the easiest move. I don't know if owners would be willing to budge on that because it saves them money in the long term by tagging these guys and not having to pay them and then just, you know, dumping them and getting somebody else to fill the position. But certainly for the players, it is, you know, a want. You don't want the franchise tag. And with running backs, you know, you can, if the franchise tag is eliminated, you can work around it on the contracts. Like there, they would be much more open to being like, okay, I'll get a front-loaded contract and then if things go south, you can cut me for a small amount of dead cap, and then that's it. That helps everyone in the long run rather than just, you know, franchise tagging someone, and now all of a sudden this guy's a journeyman and he has to go for like minimum contracts other places. That's not necessarily fair either. So yeah, get rid of the franchise tag, I guess, would be the likely solution. But regardless, Saquon probably aggravated a little bit of the running backs who were like, we stand in unity. And Saquon was like, gonna hold out. He wasn't gonna participate in training camp. He wasn't gonna participate in training camp. He wasn't gonna get fined because he didn't sign the franchise tag. And then, you know, at the beginning of the season, he would sign the franchise tag and then just play. And then they have to deal with it next year. This is Saquon's compensation. He agreed to a new one-year deal. So I guess the deadline, I thought the deadline maybe was just contracts in general, but it's not. The deadline that happened last week was specifically multi-year contract extensions with your team. So Saquon, instead of signing the franchise tag, he signs a new one-year deal worth up to $11 million, which beats the franchise tag, which was going to be somewhere around 10.1, I think it was. This is it. Okay, so but it was around that. So Saquon agrees to a one-year deal with the Giants worth $10.1 million fully guaranteed, including a $2 million upfront signing bonus. And the deal includes $1 million in incentives with an equal amount paid for 1,300 rushing yards, 11 touchdowns, and 65 receptions. So if he hits all of those, he gets another $1 million. And in total, this year, with incentives, he could make up to $13 million, including his signing bonus with the New York Giants. So he reported the training camp today. Bright and early, he's like a true professional. He signed his contract. Boom, day one, he's there. Didn't even take a day to kind of like relax and show up for day two. Nope, he's there for day one. I love Saquon Barkley. I'm so happy he was able to get this deal done. I still believe the Giants should agree to a multi-year contract with him when the season is over. Because the one alarming thing is, as Adam Schefter tweeted, there was no franchise deal clause in this new one-year deal contract, which I guess you can do. I wasn't even aware that was an option in contracts, but Schefter's tweet would imply that Saquon could have negotiated that. Hey, if I sign this one-year deal to play for this season, you guys can't. There's a clause in there that you guys cannot franchise tag me a second time next year. Which they can do now, because apparently that clause isn't in the contract. They can do that. So if the end of the season comes around and the Giants want to franchise tag Saquon Barkley, they can. However, there is an increase in the franchise tag. It's going to be more than the 10 point whatever million dollars it was this year. It's going to jump. I would imagine a handful of millions of dollars. And that would then instigate the point like, do we even want a franchise tag Saquon Barkley? Because that's a lot of money for this year to be paying him. So maybe we should just negotiate a deal to now we're paying him less or more upfront money, whatever it is. So yeah, they can franchise tag him next year. If they do, that would probably sever their relationship. Like Saquon, now you're not dealing in good faith at all, and Saquon is probably going to burn down the Giants facility if you do that. So ideally, this means that at some point they're going to come to a agreement on the deal, and things will be okay. I'd hope. But for now, in the short term, at least for this next season, Saquon Barkley is a New York Giant, and he'll be making a good amount of money. He'll be all right. Not as much as Jaylen Brown, of course, but he'll be making a good amount of money. In baseball news, we got the 2024 Hall of Fame ballot list. For those of you who do not know, for whatever reason, this past weekend, Fred McGriff and Scott Rolen got inducted into the Hall of Fame as the class of 2023. They are the only ones to do so. So yeah, it's a little controversial, I guess. Fred McGriff, sure. Scott Rolen, I'm not sold on Scott Rolen being a Hall of Famer. I'm not. And I haven't been for several months since he actually got elected, voted in, which is when, I don't know when that happened, back in like December or January-ish, I think it is. I didn't like it. I thought it was weird. I thought it was nonsense, honestly. I just didn't think he was a guy that should have been elected into the Hall of Fame. Like, when I think of Scott Rolen, I don't think Hall of Famer, unfortunately. So it's certainly muddied the waters a little bit, especially for me. But let's go through the list. So the guys who are returning on the ballot, these are only players. I'll get to the other players in a bit, but these are only players that received 25% or more on the ballot. This is from a graphic tweeted by MLB. So Carlos Beltran, Todd Helton, Andrew Jones, Manny Ramirez, Alex Rodriguez, Gary Sheffield, and Billy Wagner. Those are all returning players that had 25% or more. The ones who didn't have 25% or more that are still returning on the ballot, because you need 5% or more to stay on the ballot for the Hall of Fame. If you receive less than 5, you're out. So the ones who received 5 or more: Omar Vizquel, Andy Pettit, Bobby Abreu, Jimmy Rollins, Mark Burley, Francisco Rodriguez, and Torrey Hunter. Now, all of these guys are so low. Vizquel's the highest at 19.5%. Pettit, 17. Abreu, 15.4. Rollins, 12.9. Burley, 10.8. K-Rod, 10.8. And Torrey Hunter, 6.9. So Torrey Hunter barely stays on the ballot. None of those guys are getting into the Hall of Fame. It's just their ballot numbers are too low. They'll hang around for a little bit and then eventually might fall off. But I don't think any of these guys are capable of climbing the ladder quickly enough to get into the Hall of Fame. I don't think their resumes really age into that fact as much. Even though Andy Pettit, to me, you know, he's arguably the greatest postseason pitcher of all time. He has the most postseason wins ever. He's a 5-time World Series champion, but those two stats alone don't back up the rest of his resume. He doesn't have like 300 wins. He doesn't have like a crazy great ERA or an overwhelming amount of strikeouts. So unfortunately, I just don't think that gets it done. Andy Pettit, by the way, rejoined the Yankees as a consultant to the pitching staff, which I like. So he's back with the organization. I wrote a ballot for Animal House yesterday, and I said something like, I remember Torrey Hunter being a problem. Like, Torrey Hunter, in my mind, when I think of him, is a really good baseball player. Not even going to sniff the Hall of Fame, I don't think. So, in terms of these guys, now let's look at the newcomers. Adrian Beltre, Adrian Gonzalez, Joe Mauer, Chase Utley, David Wright. A-Rod and Manny are on that list of returning players. I do not think either one of them are getting to the Hall of Fame. I think they are. So they got, A-Rod got 30, A-Rod just narrowly has more percentage than Manny. A-Rod received 35.7% on his ballot, which I believe was his first year, and Manny Ramirez received 33.2. Do I think either one of them can actually make the Hall of Fame? No. Or I shouldn't say that. Realistically, do I think either one of them will make the Hall of Fame? No. I think they are probably resigned to the same fate as Roger Clemens and Barry Bonds, which is stay on the ballot for 10 years and never cross the 75% threshold. It just makes me so angry because David Ortiz definitely did steroids and he's in the Hall of Fame. And it was like everyone pretended that he didn't do steroids, which was crazy. But with A-Rod and Manny, Alex Rodriguez is the only person who has ever been linked to steroids who is actively trying to change his image in the baseball community. He's trying to change his image with the media. He's trying to change his image with fans and with other contemporaries of his alike. I think he's done a really, really, really good job of it. He is a great analyst on Fox and ESPN. He is a lover of the game. The guy watches, eats, sleeps, breathes baseball. That's just, it's in his blood. You could say whatever you want about how he acted on the field and during his playing days, but he has gone above and beyond to try and repair his reputation with the people that are the ones responsible for letting people into the Hall of Fame. He really is like this guy that, because you look at everyone else, Clemens has never sucked up to the media, and he is on record with just like, I've made peace with the fact that I'm not getting in the Hall of Fame. I do not care. Barry Bonds, at no point in his life, ever respected or liked or cared about the media. Hated them from his rookie year to his final year. Hated them. Is part of the reason because of how the media treated him during the steroid stuff? Yeah, of course it is. But even before the steroid stuff, like, he hated the media when he was in Pittsburgh. He hated the media. Was not rocking with them at all. So he's never been about any of that shit. So he doesn't care. Other steroid guys like Manny Ramirez got suspended for like an entire year for playing steroids, and rather than serve the suspension and come back, he just said, screw this, I'm retiring, and went to go play like in the Dominican Republic somewhere, right? Like, he just buzzed off. He didn't even care enough to serve the suspension, so he's not going to get into the Hall of Fame. A-Rod, if there's anyone that's going to get in and they're going to have like an asterisk and be like, he used known steroid user in these years of his playing career, it could be A-Rod. And I think just as it's going to be interesting, like, are there going to be guys over the next 9 or 8 years or so that is there going to be enough people that are get a vote for the Hall of Fame that let A-Rod in? I'm not entirely sure. You know, 33% or whatever it was is not a very high number. If he was immediately floating around in like the 40s or 50s, I'd be even more optimistic. But it's a almost near impossible climb that A-Rod would have to make to get into the Hall of Fame. So unfortunately, those two guys aren't going to get in, even though they absolutely deserve it. So the people who I think are actually on this ballot that should get in and have a reasonable chance to get in the newcomers, Beltre and Mauer. And then for the returning guys, Todd Helton, Billy Wagner, Andrew Jones, Gary Sheffield, Carlos Beltran. Carlos Beltran is the lowest on this list for returning members at 46.5%. And Todd Helton is the highest at 72.2%. Now, if you ask me, out of all these players, Carlos Beltran's one of the best. So the fact that he's like so low is crazy to me. Gary Sheffield has over 500 home runs. And how many hits does he have? like 20 something over, well over 2,000 hits, just shy, I think. But there's no reason why Gary Sheffield shouldn't be in the Hall of Fame already. Other than the loose link to his steroids. But he is about as connected to steroids as Jeff Bagwell and Mike Piazza are. And they're in the Hall of Fame. And Pudge, too. Ivan Rodriguez. And he's in the Hall of Fame. So, Sheffield should get in. Andrew Jones, he's probably the weakest out of all the bunch because of how his offensive numbers fell off a cliff after he left Atlanta. Billy Wagner's at 68.1%. He needs a little... He's going into his ninth year on the ballot. He could get in. If he doesn't get in next year, he'll definitely get in his final year, his 10th year, because generally speaking, players get an extra bump from writers when it's their final year on the ballot. That's how Edgar Martinez got in. Todd Helton's practically kissing 75%, so he'll get in next year. Beltran, Sheffield, and Andrew Jones, honestly, I don't think they get in next year, even though they absolutely should. Carlos Beltran's at 46.5%. For reference, he is one of seven players to hit 200-plus home runs in both the American League and the National League. You know who the other ones are? Albert Pujols, Ken Griffey Jr., Fred McGriff, Frank Robinson, Mark McGwire, and who's the other one? There's one other person. Pujols. Oh, Vlad Guerrero Sr. Those other six guys, and then Carlos Beltran is the seventh. They have all hit 200-plus home runs in the AL and the NL. And what's the common thread with those other six guys? They're all Hall of Famers. Pujols isn't a Hall of Famer yet, but he's going to be. But they're all Hall of Famers. So it's like, he absolutely deserves it. And on top of that, he was one of the best center fielders of his generation. So there's no reason why he shouldn't be in. Now let's look at some of the other guys that are definitely not going to make it. Adrian Gonzalez, not going to make it. Chase Utley, David Wright. Chase Utley just doesn't have the numbers, and David Wright doesn't have the numbers because of his injury history. If David Wright stayed healthy, like he had another at least 5 or 6 years of solid baseball left, could have sat atop alone in the Mets records books and been an all-time great baseball player and could have been remembered as one of the best third basemen of all time, but his body just absolutely betrayed him after he turned 30. And we were never able to see that. So I don't think Utley and Wright have a chance. I think Adrian Gonzalez, while he was impressive for a handful of years, just, again, doesn't have the longevity. So Adrian Beltre, 470-plus home runs, over 3,000 hits. Gold gloves, platinum gloves, silver sluggers. Just one of the best all-around baseball players of his generation. And to be honest, I think was someone that was very underrated during his career. But a very good baseball player. He's going to get in first ballot. Joe Mauer should get in first ballot. If he doesn't, it's a crime, but he should then get in second ballot for sure if he misses the cut for first ballot. But he should absolutely be in the Hall of Fame. And here's the reason. Joe Mauer is on a very short list of dominant catchers for their entire careers. It's like Buster Posey and, I mean, Salvador Perez, maybe? But offensively dominant catchers. Do you know how hard it is in the modern game of baseball to win an MVP as a catcher? You have to be like unbelievable. And Joe Mauer was that. He has two batting titles in 1 year. His power numbers surged to 28 home runs. He never, I don't think, eclipsed 20 in the rest of his career. So he had like this 1 year where he had some good power numbers, RBIs. He won a batting title. He was just the definition of a professional hitter. And then on top of that was an elite defensive catcher, and then when his age finally caught up to him, was a plus defensive first baseman. So Joe Mauer definitely deserves to be in the Hall of Fame. He's like a guy, him and Buster Posey are like two of the most dominant catchers I've ever seen in my life. Again, you have to be an exceptional player to win MVP as a catcher. Because a lot of times with catchers, you know, even if they're not great offensively, if they're exceptional defensively, teams will keep them around. You know, some guys make a living off of catching one specific pitcher for their entire careers, right? Because they call a great game and they have great chemistry with that pitcher, and like they just know each other really well. And they'll stay around, but they won't really contribute a whole lot. And then on the other end, there are some catchers that are like, they're brought up and they're not really great defensively, but they have a crazy power bat. So, or not necessarily power, that's more of like the stereotypical type, but they just have a really good bat. You know, they excel at the plate. So you move them. Now there's the universal DH. So now you can just DH them. You move them to first base if you want, whatever it is, as long as their bat's in the lineup. But they don't necessarily have to be your starting catcher. So to be the best option as the catcher and then also your team's best hitter, like Posey and Mauer were, and win MVP, it's nothing to scoff at in the modern day of baseball. It's incredibly, incredibly difficult to do. So Joe Mauer, I think, deserves to be a first ballot Hall of Famer. And based on the track record of the Baseball Writers Association of America, I think the only other two guys that are going to get in, I think it's going to be a four-person ballot next year. Beltre and Mauer from the newcomers, and then Helton and Billy Wagner from the returning members. Unfortunately, I don't think Sheffield, Andrew Jones, Carlos Beltran get in, even though, again, they absolutely deserve to be in the Hall of Fame. Bottom line here, the Baseball Writers, they've really made it difficult to gauge who is a Hall of Famer and who isn't after the Scott Rolen thing. I'm not even kidding. Like, it may sound like I'm exaggerating a ton, but letting him into the Hall of Fame really, really muddies the waters, because are you going to look me in the eye and say that Carlos Beltran, Andrew Jones, Gary Sheffield were not better baseball players than Scott Rolen? I think they were. I really think they were. All of them at their peaks. So for me, at least, it stems a source of frustration, because now we're really in like the muck of things where, I mean, we have been for a few years, honestly, where all of these guys that are entering these Hall of Fame ballots are all players that I grew up watching. Like, strictly, basically, players that I grew up watching. So, I am nostalgic, sure. I think, to a degree, that is, you know, maybe hindering my opinion a bit. But I try to be as objective as possible. You know, both in the statistical mindset and the, I watch them play with my own two eyes so I know how good they are mindset, you know, the eyeball test, as they say. So I'm sorry. I don't think Scott Rolen's better than those players, and he's in the Hall of Fame, so they should be too. It's literally just as simple as that. You can't pick and choose. You can't play favorites. You can't just be like, he was a nice guy. Like, no. And the Baseball Hall of Fame has always been the second strictest. I would say the Pro Football Hall of Fame is pretty stingy when it comes to who gets in and who doesn't. Because there are guys still on that ballot where it's like, I can't believe this is like their third or fourth year on the ballot and they're not in the Hall of Fame yet. But with baseball, it's kind of the same way. Some guys wait a long time to get in, and it's just, they should have been in. You know, I don't know, man. Sometimes waiting on the ballot, improve your game on paper somehow becomes better. Like, why is, I don't know. I think the multiple returning ballots is stupid. I think but you can't trust these writers to make the right decision, because to me, it's like, I look at some of these guys, are they a Hall of Famer? Yes, no, yes, no, yes, 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 no, no, no. Like, that's it. End of story. You're in or you're out. It should be that simple, but it's not, because people have vendettas. So it's a major flaw, but I have no real way of fixing it. So I can complain all I want, but until I somehow figure out a way to fix the Baseball Hall of Fame voting system, it's just going to stay a source of frustration for me. Different source of frustration, the trade deadline, August 1st for the MLB. Yeah, a lot of questions here. Like, are the Mets, are they selling? Are they buying for next year? Doubling down on the unit, the team that they have? Questionable. I mean, Steve Cohen doesn't strike me as the kind of guy who's going to trade off players. So I would expect them to be at least a little active. The Yankees, same thing. There is no one player that they can go out and get right now that will immediately make them a playoff team. That includes Shohei Ohtani. Even if the Yankees go out and get Ohtani, we will not make the playoffs, okay? It's not going to change things. As for the Angels, that's the most pressing matter. I mean, all these teams, you know, they're going to be making moves. The Reds are on the market. I think they came out and said they would be willing to trade Jonathan India, which doesn't make any sense to me, but whatever. Other teams like that. A lot of teams this year that you maybe just were not expecting to be competitive are now competitive. So the Reds being one of them. The Diamondbacks being a huge issue in the AL West, right? The Padres are bad. Do they ship off Juan Soto? If you're asking me as a Yankee fan, who I would rather have? Do you want me to give up prospects for Shohei Ohtani, or do you want me to give up prospects for Juan Soto? Give me Juan Soto. I will take Juan Soto very much. Thank you, please. It would be nice to have someone who gets on base 45% of the time. I would very much enjoy having someone like that in our lineup next to Aaron Judge. That would be great. And he would work fine in that outfield. We need a left fielder. Go ahead and throw him out there. But I'll trade whatever prospects you need. Dominguez, sure, get him out of here. I don't care. Anyone else? Yeah. I'll trade them too. For Juan Soto. He's 24 years old. This isn't like, I mean, Shohei Ohtani is like 27, right? 28. He's in like the prime of his career. But Soto is 24 years old, bro. Sign him to a 13-year contract. I don't care. He's a monster, man. He is a monster. With that short porch, too, and right... Oh, you missed out on Bryce Harper. Get Juan Soto. It's so simple. Oh. Anyways. Yeah, I know that might be a little bit controversial for me. If, like, the Yankees are going to ship out their top prospects for somebody, let it be Juan Soto and the Padres instead of Shohei Ohtani. But with the Angels, they are in a dilemma. No one wants to trade for Shohei Ohtani because no one knows if he's going to re-sign with them. So, do you give up a lot of prospects for a rental? Obviously not. You don't want to. Here's the problem with the Angels. He definitely does not want to stay there. That is like the biggest problem they have is that he is very much like, I'm souring on this franchise with each passing day. So I want to get to the playoffs. I want to compete and I want to win. And I want everyone else in the world who might not have a chance to watch me every night, watch me play in the playoffs. That's what I want. Like, he wants to be the guy. He wants to have a chance to win. He's a competitor. The Angels do not provide that. Why? They have terrible pitching. It's always the pitching. It's been the pitching for like the past 5 or 6 years. That's been the problem, is the pitching. They score plenty of runs, trust me. So he's basically been pretty, as transparent as you can possibly be without actually saying the words, Shohei Ohtani is telling the Angels he's going to leave. So that's a problem because he's not going to re-sign. And teams don't necessarily really seem to be in the position to, it's not like teams are lining up out the door to give away their best prospects to get Shohei Ohtani for what could potentially be a rental if the right team doesn't step up to the plate, right? So now with the Angels, it's like, okay, well, we don't really have any leverage whatsoever, because there's no bidding war going on, and the chances of him agreeing to a contract extension are foggy at best. So now with Ohtani and the Angels, there's a very real possibility that he leaves for nothing, the Angels lose a generational defining talent for nothing. It's a nightmare. It's a nightmare, bro. I thought the Angels were selling. I guess they haven't sold, or they just kind of forgot about that and aren't dealing with that anymore. I don't know what the deal is, but yeah, they're in trouble. All right, but that is our sports. That's sports for today. We're going to go to Barbenheimer now, which I'm sure everyone has been very excited for. I mean, it's been a huge, like, basically worldwide phenomena. The only thing I'm a little bit worried about is that, you know, these corporate, greedy, hungry studio monsters are going to see, like, oh, people liked when, you know, there was two completely different genres of movies coming out on the same day, and it was quirky, and it was fun, and everyone went to the theater, and both movies made a bunch of money. We should try and plan, quote-unquote, plan that more often. That'll be fun. I hope that doesn't become a thing where they're now, like, forcing it on us, because that was a very wholesome, like, internet-created thing. That the PR teams of these movies and marketing teams of these movies took notice of and then really leaned into and started playing into it. And, you know, it turned out great for both ends. Both movies were really good. The acting in both movies was really good. And, you know, they were both completely different and both wildly successful. Barbie made more money, but Oppenheimer crushed it as well. I think it was like the third highest opening weekend for a Christopher Nolan film behind The Dark Knight Rises and The Dark Knight. So pretty dope. We'll start with Oppenheimer. And the one thing about Oppenheimer that is very apparent when you watch this movie is that this is not a movie about the atomic bomb being dropped on Japan. This is a movie about J. Robert Oppenheimer, the quote-unquote father of the atomic bomb, the guy who helped design it. But it is very much about him, because I know I saw a lot of people come out on social media and stuff being like, I think it takes away from the fact that they didn't show the bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and if that's like, that takes away from, you know, the destruction and mayhem that he caused, and the, you know, the weight of this decision. But it really doesn't, because this movie is about Oppenheimer, and they didn't see the destruction of those cities that they did. They didn't see it. Did the guilt weigh heavy on his conscience? Sure. But let's break it down with this movie. So there are two stories being told. There, as they mentioned in the beginning, there's one fusion and two fission. Fusion is the storyline that is told in color, which is through the eyes of Oppenheimer himself. So this goes through how he kind of saw things playing out, how he recalled things playing out. And then the two, fission, is told in black and white through the viewpoint of Louis Strauss, not Strauss, as they go out of their way to mention in the movie, Louis Strauss, who's played by Robert Downey Jr. And I actually got that flipped. So fission is in color with Robert Oppenheimer's more subjective point of view. And then in black and white is the more objective. I mean, I guess it's kind of objective. Robert Downey Jr. as Louis Strauss kind of serves as an antagonist almost to Oppenheimer in this movie, because he does try and, you know, degrade his career and get his security clearance revoked and all that kind of stuff. So he's kind of like the villain there. But that's told in black and white, and then Oppenheimer's view is told in color, and both timelines in color and in black and white also have moments of flashbacks within those stories that are being told. So it does get a bit confusing, but basically all you have to remember, if you still haven't seen it going into that, is that in color is Oppenheimer's point of view, and there are flashbacks within that point of view, and then in Black and White is Lewis Strauss' point of view, which again also have some flashbacks in there. But yeah, that's basically the bottom line of it. And you can piece that together as the movie goes on. But I think the part that maybe loses a lot of people, because in the beginning it's pretty clear cut, like, okay, you know, color is Oppenheimer, black and white is Strauss, RDJ. But then the flashbacks within those two separate stories being told kind of throws you into a loop. And Nolan does that all the time with, no pun intended, all the time. He does mess around with time a lot and how storylines and plot lines work. He did it in Dunkirk. He did it in Inception. He did it in probably his least successful effort, Tenet. But yeah, once you get past that, it's pretty streamlined. So it seems to be at that, in the moment, the main anchor point is the hearing. That's the main, present day, that would be in those terms, the main anchor point between these two stories being told, where Strauss is trying to get Oppenheimer's security clearance revoked, which does happen. And they reveal that Strauss had, you know, even though he promoted Oppenheimer to this head of physics department or whatever, Oppenheimer humiliated him during one point in a hearing with his knowledge on physics, and he had never forgotten that. And he was so obsessed with, like, what Oppenheimer said to Albert Einstein when Strauss, he offered to introduce the two, and Oppenheimer was like, I've known him for years. And he says something to Einstein, who walks past Strauss, kind of like blanking out, completely ignoring Strauss. And Strauss was like, what did you say to him? And Oppenheimer never told him. And he had been like obsessed with that fact. And that's the final line of the movie. We finally get to hear what Oppenheimer told Einstein. And it's along the lines of, you remember when I brought you those numbers years ago where we were running calculations about how if we set off the atomic bomb, the chain reaction may never stop and we could set fire to the atmosphere. There was like a 0.00000000001% that it could happen. But they nonetheless were a bit terrified of it. And Einstein was like, yeah, I remember it well. He said, you know, Oppenheimer was like, the threat that we could set fire to the world with the push of a button, I believe we did. And Einstein was obviously shook from that, which, it's true, you know, since the creation of the atomic bomb, it's been nothing but mutually assured destruction that has stopped countries from blowing each other up. Because everyone's got nukes, everyone's got bombs. So he has essentially created this world, and it was a chilling ending line to the movie. But like I said, it follows Oppenheimer from the time of his overseas studies to the time that he is credited with bringing physics like that to America in that capacity, and teaching other students, and then through the Manhattan Project and the testing of the atomic bomb in the middle of what is Los Alamos, Utah, something like that, or Nevada, whatever it is. They blow it, they detonate the first atomic bomb in the desert. And I don't actually know if there was plutonium in it, or maybe there was plutonium in it. Yeah, but regardless, they set off the bomb to test it, and it's a chilling scene where there's no sound, and it's just you see the explosion. It just continues to get bigger and bigger, and then eventually, even after they're talking, you hear the boom, because there's so many miles away. It's done really well. So there's so many miles away that explosions, big noises, take a while for the sound to travel. If you've ever been to a baseball game, like a Little League baseball game, and you watch it from afar, when a kid would hit the bat, the metal bat to the ball, you could see the ball is is already in the air before you actually hear the ding of the metal bat. So it's just that, but on a much, much larger scale. Like, they are miles and miles and miles and miles away from this explosion. And then you get the big, giant clap roar from this initial explosion, and then the shock waves sending through to everybody else. It is a really, really chilling scene. There is a lot of really moments in this movie where your hair stands on the back of your neck because it's so messed up. There's one scene that a lot of people pointed to where they're in a hearing and they're discussing a list of cities to nuke in Japan. And it's a list of 11 cities. And the guy goes, oh, actually, crosses one off. He goes, 10 cities. I've crossed off Kyoto as an option because of its historical significance to the people of Japan. And then he looks away and he looks back up, kind of smirks, and he says, also, me and my wife stay there sometimes, and it's a very nice place. So because he and his wife honeymooned or vacationed in Kyoto, he doesn't want it to be nuked. It's like such a casual statement, and it really like highlights the fact that we're at war, and the people really don't have a grasp on just how devastating something like this is going to be. Another highlighted moment is where Oppenheimer goes to the president, goes to Truman in the Oval Office, who's played by Gary Oldman, by the way, which I didn't even realize that was Gary Oldman. It looks nothing like him. Makeup department, A-plus job. This movie's going to be nominated for Cillian Murphy, Best Actor, RDJ, Best Supporting Actor, Emily Blunt, Best Supporting Actress, Best Adapted Screenplay, Best Director, Best Cinematography, Best Makeup. It's going to be nominated for everything. But with this conversation they have, Oppenheimer is basically admitting like guilt and regret. And Truman looks at him, he's like, you did not drop the bombs on Hiroshima. And then Oppenheimer goes, and Nagasaki, and he's like, or Nagasaki. He's like, I did. With like a big nuts kind of energy. You know, he's like, I dropped the bombs. It was me. Not you. You just made them. I dropped them. So Oppenheimer is then escorted out of the Oval Office, and you hear Truman say as he's walking out, never let that crybaby back in here again. So he's like done with Oppenheimer. And they have a line there where, your country needs us. And then it's like, until they don't, you know? And at this point, there was many foreshadowing moments in the movie where it was kind of like, you know, they need you until they don't. You're the hero until you become the villain. Like, and that's what really this hearing centers around, getting Oppenheimer's clearance revoked. Straw's kind of, he's trying to smear campaign Oppenheimer, basically, because they investigate him for being a communist because his brother and his wife joined the Communist Party, and Oppenheimer had communist-leaning views, specifically with, like, union stuff and the like. So people really, the government specifically, like, they hounded on him and almost, you know, he tried to, in a way, make himself a martyr in the movie, which his wife gets on him about. It's like, stop trying to make yourself a martyr and fight. But he didn't, really. And they tried to take his security clearance away and run a smear campaign. And in the end, they said, we have concluded that you are a loyal citizen to your country. However, we are going to revoke your security clearance. So it happens anyway. And then Straw's is then equally denied entry into the president's cabinet, which is something that he wanted. So they both lose things in the end there. And it's like really, really a riveting story. And that just shows to the fact that the writing is excellent. More so now than anything, for me, when the writing is exceptional, nothing else needs to be happening. And that's basically what this movie is. This movie is really, a majority of its runtime, people sitting around discussing things. They're discussing physics. They're discussing numbers. They're discussing building the bomb. They're discussing Oppenheimer's security clearance. There are court hearings, which are, the court scenes are also incredibly riveting, by the way. And there's just names up and down this place where, like, Josh Peck has, like, two lines of dialogue. Rami Malek came in and shot for, they said, I think RDJ said in an interview, he shot for one day, and he has, like, three scenes. Two of them he doesn't talk, and in the other one, he has, like, two lines of dialogue in a court scene. So, he is an award-winning actor and has, like, two lines of dialogue in this movie. It's honestly cool. Like, they have so many great actors playing such small parts, and it just makes everything so elite when you have no bad performances. And the writing is so on point that even though the most action, quote-unquote, action-packed part of this movie is the bomb testing, everything else is still, like, incredibly riveting. You never feel like you're getting bored. You never feel like the movie is dragging on. And it's a 3-hour runtime. So in a 3-hour movie where it's basically all dialogue, to be captivated like that is a testament to the writing and also a testament to Christopher Nolan's storytelling, because the parallel stories being told in color and in black and light, black and white, mixed in with the flashbacks, keep you engaged. Because you want to know what's going on. You have to piece together a little bit as the story goes on. Like, okay, this is from so-and-so's point of view, and this is when this is happening. This is before that. This is after that. Blah, blah, blah. Whatever it is. You're trying to figure it out, but you're trying to stay engaged and digest all this information that you're getting. So it is a really, really, really well-done movie. Like I said, it's going to be nominated top to bottom at the Academy Awards. No doubt about it. And I enjoyed it, spoiler alert, I enjoyed it more than Barbie. Go see the movie if you haven't already. I don't really have to give too many spoilers. I don't really feel like I gave too many spoilers in this kind of review, but it is a biopic, so more or less you know what happens. But yeah, it's crazy. And then after all this fallout, I thought this was a great scene to add. At the end, this is the only time that they jump away from the established stories that they're telling, is at the end of the movie, after the fallout of, you know, he gets his security clearance revoked, he has the beef with straws and all this stuff that negatively happened, where they were basically, after everyone realized how horrible it was to nuke Japan, right? Because that was really the moral dilemma, was like, Oppenheimer built the bomb, yes, because he didn't want the Nazis to have it first. So in his mind, he's like, I'm going to build this bomb, and then everyone's just going to stop. And everyone's going to be like, America has the bomb. We have to stop doing everything. Otherwise, you know, we're done. We're not going to do anything. But the main point that people in the military were trying to drive home was like, Japan is not going to give up. Even if we build the bomb and show, like, they were trying to say, is there any way we can show the destructive power of this bomb without actually dropping it on people. And I forgot who says it, but there's a chilling line that they say where he goes, we have to drop the bomb twice. Once to show its destructive power, and again to show that we can keep doing it over and over and over. And it's like so insidious, because Oppenheimer and the other scientists that worked on it, there is a scene where he's wearing like the military uniform that Leslie gives him, Matt Damon's character, who was also terrific in this film, by the way. Everyone was terrific, but he's wearing like the military coat, and one of his colleagues looks at him and he's like, you're a scientist. You're not in the military. Like, you look ridiculous. And that is a real like message there, because the scientists and the military during this project, they didn't necessarily see eye to eye. You know, Oppenheimer knew what he was building. He knew what he was creating. But at the same time, he never really wanted it to be used. He wanted it to be made as a deterrent. And all of this stems from Einstein writing the president that he fears the Germans will have a nuke. And then that's what sprung all of this. So it's crazy. Like that line, the line about not bombing Kyoto because, you know, him and his wife honeymoon, the guy who was discussing it, him and his wife honeymoon there, that's chilling. The other line with like, we have to nuke them twice, once to show its power and then once to show them that we can keep doing it again and again. That's like badass shit. Like bad, it's bad, but it's badass too. Like it's such like a complete disregard for the amount of human lives that you're taking. It is a bizarre time in our history as a country, and it's just, it's crazy. And I think it's just really, really well done. So those were a couple moments that really stood out to me. And then the ending scene is equally as chilling. Just a great bit of dialogue there. And all the writing was just top tier. I would say it's a top five Nolan film. I'd still put, I don't know if I like it more than Dunkirk. It's close. I think Dunkirk and them are close. I really like Memento. I would say The Dark Knight and Inception are still probably my two favorite Nolan movies, but this is certainly one of his better films. And it was really, really good. I had all the confidence in the world that this was going to be an elite film, and it paid out in spades. So Oppenheimer, I'm going to give it a 9.5 out of 10. It's an incredible, I'll give it a 9 actually. I'll give it a 9 out of 10. It's a great movie. I really enjoyed it. If I had to say anything bad about it, I would say like the womanizing part of Oppenheimer was a bit weird. You know, the whole affair with Florence Pugh. I'm not really sure if, because they included it to kind of be like, this is the kind of person that Oppenheimer was, and this is like his psyche and how his brain works and stuff. But I don't know. Didn't really feel necessary to include those scenes. And yeah, there was, you know, the whole, he reads from Sanskrit, which people were, you know, people not in America were very, very upset about. He reads from Sanskrit where he's like having, you know, Florence Pugh's on top of him naked. And he reads, that's where he reads the "I am become death, destroyer of worlds" line from Sanskrit while a naked Florence Pugh's on top of him. A lot of people weren't happy about that. Also, I mean, to me, it didn't piss me off, of course, but it did seem unnecessary. I think all of Florence Pugh's scenes kind of felt a little unnecessary. And it's not a whole lot of runtime either. Like that screen time that they shared together is practically inconsequential to the rest of the story. You don't really need it there, but they included it. So I guess, you know, it's fine. It didn't like distract me or like disengage me from the rest of the movie. It like that in any case, but there wasn't, in hindsight, after digesting the movie, that definitely felt like the part that was the most unnecessary. So if I had a negative, it's that. Now for the other half of Barbenheimer, of course, Barbie. So Margot Robbie, Ryan Gosling, and a bunch of other actors, both of the casts for these movies were thick. Like, just a lot of well-known faces in both of these movies. Barbie was great. I was a little concerned for the movie, just because I had heard so many different things. I saw some scenes on TikTok and stuff, but I wasn't fully ready for what I saw. And like, I wasn't totally aware of how this story was going to be told. There's fourth wall breaking. There's narration. There's a point where the narrator, Margot Robbie, Barbie, is crying and saying, like, I don't feel pretty, I feel sad, blah, blah, blah. And then the narrator comes on and says, note to the directors that if you want to make this scene work, try not to cast Margot Robbie. And it was funny. Like, the entire movie was really funny and really quippy and very topical and a lot of social commentary. That was the one thing too. I knew it was going to be some social commentary, but I was hoping that it wasn't over the top. So like Adam McKay did that in the climate change movie. What was the name of it? Don't Look Up, right? I think that was it. He did that in that movie where it really like smashes you over the head with social commentary and like jokes that are really, really poignant, and there's like no room for interpretation, and that's not always funny. Sometimes it is, but it's not always funny. Barbie, I think, did a good job of towing that line to where it was enjoyable for the majority of the film. Are there some moments where they tried to be funny or silly and it wasn't really that funny or silly? Yeah, there were, but for the most part, I laughed a ton, especially in the beginning when they're strictly in Barbie world. It is very good. I thought Margot Robbie as Barbie, of course, was good. She had a great performance. She had a wide array of emotions and brought a lot of depth and character to Barbie, which I can guarantee you a lot of people were not expecting, made her a real movie character with depth and feelings and intelligence and emotion, and I think it worked really well. But by far and away, unquestionably, I think, the star of this movie is Ryan Gosling as Ken. Every single scene he is in, whether it's by himself or with Margot Robbie, he steals the show. He is by far the best actor in this movie, and he is a funny character and also serves as a slight antagonist in the third act of the movie where Barbie returns to Barbie Land and Ken had already went back and created Mojo Dojo, Ken's Mojo Dojo Casa House, which ended up being a great financial success for Mattel. So basically, this movie, let me just run through the plot real quick. This movie starts in Barbie Land with all the Barbies and all the Kens, and Barbie, our Barbie, stereotypical Barbie, as she is called in the movie, which is OG Barbie, blonde hair, skinny, very pretty. That's the doll that some people point to and say, I hate her, whatever. She has a crisis of death. And everyone's like, what the hell? And these weird feelings of human emotions where everything's not like 100% perfect and the day is great start to plague her. And she's like, what's going on? She goes to Crazy Barbie's house, who eventually tells her that her child that is playing with her is projecting these emotions onto her, and this is why she's feeling this way. So she has to go to the real world, which are just a multiple steps of travel for Barbies to eventually get to like Venice Beach in California. She goes there. It turns out that it's not the child that she had visions of. It's actually the mother of the child that she had visions of, and that's why these emotions of death and feeling inadequate and being sad and all that kind of stuff are plaguing her, because they have come from an adult woman who has gone through a lot of emotional turmoil in her life. It's a good representation. There's a whole speech about how hard it is being a woman, and then Ken goes on this whole adventure about how it's so easy being a man and the patriarchy, which he institutes into Barbie Land, and that's why it becomes Ken's Mojo Dojo Casa House. But Then Mattel gets involved. There's a very meta concept of Mattel controlling everything, and they know about Barbie World, and they want to try and send Barbie back in the box, and then they chase after her in this funny chase scene, and then they eventually get to Barbie Land and whatever. So the whole Mattel thing is led by Will Ferrell, who is funny, but overall is kind of, it's kind of like a gaggy sort of thing. They didn't really need it, because even though they infiltrate Barbie Land and they're in like the final act of the movie and they're supposed to be quote unquote the antagonist, Ken and the other Kens serve more as an antagonist than Mattel does. So Mattel doesn't, that whole plot line doesn't necessarily have to be a major part of the movie. Can the woman who is Barbie's human connection work at Mattel still? Because she does. If you want to include that in the movie, yeah, you can. If you want to have Mattel with like some funny throwaway lines with Will Ferrell, that'd be fine too. But they didn't really have to serve as a big, as the face of the antagonist, because Ken really does that well in the entire second half of the movie. There is a funny scene, there's a lot of funny scenes, and there's a lot of great social commentary about, again, how difficult it is to be a woman, the complexities of men and women in today's society, stereotypical, superficial thoughts and what people think about you and how you think of other people and all that kind of stuff. There is one moment as a man, I appreciated this. I thought it was quite funny, where the Kens go to war with each other. So it's Ryan Gosling and like his group, and then the other, I guess, alpha Ken amongst the Kens is Simu Liu's character. He plays Shang-Chi in The Legend of the Ten Rings. He is like the 1B Ken. So Ryan Gosling's like 1A stereotypical Ken, and then Simu Liu's 1B. And their two factions go to war with each other, and then during the course of that war, they end up doing a choreographed song that Ryan Gosling has been singing the entire time called I'm Just Ken. And at the end of it, they end up like throwing out and everything's like all good. So I thought it was a funny way to demonstrate how men can fight and argue and yell at each other. And then all of a sudden, you know, they just kind of forget about it and make up and everything's back to the way it was. There's a hilarious thing with Ryan Gosling where he just is a beaching. I beach. That's what he does. And they talk about a beach off. And they're like, I'm going to beach you off, dude. No, I'm going to beach you off. I'll beach you off first. And then the Barbies start getting involved. No one's beaching anybody off. Blah, blah, blah. It's a very funny play on words, obviously. But the dialogue in this movie was clever. It was quippy. It was quirky. It was impressive. I enjoyed this movie. It is definitely, in some aspects, it was what I imagined it was going to be. And in other aspects, it definitely took me by surprise. Again, from my perspective, I do not think the social commentary was overbearing. I thought it was just enough. I thought the supporting actors and actresses in this role were very well done. I think Margot Robbie and Ryan Gosling as the two main leads of this movie were exceptional. And again, I think Ryan Gosling as Ken just, he steals the show. There's really no other way to describe it. He is the highlight of the show. He is going to be nominated. Barbie's definitely going to be nominated for, like, best hair and makeup, best, I don't know if it would be cinematography, but best effects. Like, the effects in this movie, especially in Barbie World, were so creative and so original, where it was, like, this use of practical effects and special effects that they were humans, but sometimes in the way that they jumped and the way that they fell and the way, like, there's a moment where Ken tries to go surfing and he gets kicked up into the air and he flips around like a doll would. A car, when Barbie's leaving, there's the car gets kind of flipped and it's kind of like Barbie would, like a car would if you're playing with a toy where you're just kind of spinning it around. It's a really, really creative movie. So I don't know if that would be cinematography or if that would just be, I think special effects is a category in the Oscars. Hair and makeup, definitely going to be up there for Barbie. Like, the visuals of this movie are really, really, really well done. They're on par with Oppenheimer, but just in a completely different fashion. Like, just the opposite end of the spectrum as to why they're just as good as Oppenheimer, which is funny and obviously plays into the whole Barbenheimer thing. But yeah, just, I think the technicality of this movie, the technical aspects of this movie are really, really well done. I think the story has some, like, this movie was just under 2 hours. It was like an hour and 54 minutes. They probably could have shaved it down to like an hour and 40 minutes. Probably. Like, the Mattel thing doesn't really have to be a thing, to be honest, or it can be shortened. There are some moments that felt a little prolonged where you kind of just needed to get it going. I think the ending scene with Barbie going to see a gynecologist is a bit bleh. I didn't really like that, how she like chooses to become human, which is fine, but then, you know, her ending on the gag like that of I'd like to see my gynecologist or whatever was a little weird. Because it's a subversion of expectations, because you think that she's going into this big office building to get her first job, but in reality it's to see her gyno. So it's whatever, I guess. It got a couple laughs in the theater, but I thought that was a bit of a blah ending. But the scene before that, the scene where she's with Mattel's creator, Barbie's creator, Handler, I think her name is, Barbara Handler, is the daughter of the creator of Barbie. She named Barbie after her daughter, Barbara. So Barbie, when she checks into her doctor's office, she gives her name Barbara Handler. I thought that interaction that she had with Mattel's creator, Barbie's creator, about what it's like to be human and the complexities and suffering and struggles and happiness that comes with that was really, really, really beautifully done. I thought that was a top tier moment in the movie that they really forced you quickly to take it seriously for a moment and listen to the words that they are saying, not in a snobby way at all. I think most of the things that they said in this movie were very poignant, and they said, a lot of times they said it in a joking manner in a way that you can laugh but also be like, that's true. So that was a majority of the movie, but then there were times where they really had Barbie put into real emotional moments where there was some contemplation on her part and understanding on her part. And I think Margot Robbie does a really good job of being serious in a movie that is not really that serious. Those moments really stand out when you watch the movie. And if you listen to what they're saying, I think the dialogue is also really well done. So I enjoyed Barbie. I'm going to give it, honestly, I'm going to give it like an eight out of 10. They're probably the two best movies I've seen this year. I liked them both better than Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 3. And, Spider-Man is up there too. I still really enjoyed Spider-Man, but that is a part one of two parts. So in a way, Barbie and Oppenheimer were just as good, if not better. But Spider-Man is up there too. Those are probably the three best movies, I would say, so far this year. I don't think Barbie is going to be nominated for Best Picture or anything like that, even though it made like a ton of money. It made way more than Oppenheimer. But it could be nominated for Best Director, Greta Gerwig. She could be up there for Best Director, best original screenplay up there for that. Because Oppenheimer is going to be up for best adapted screenplay because it's based on one of the books, I think, or a couple books. So you have Barbie, probably best director, best supporting actor, Ryan Gosling. I don't know if this is going to get Margot Robbie a nomination for best actress. But best supporting actor, definitely Ryan Gosling up there, which is so funny to me because Robert Downey Jr. is going to be up against him as Louis Strauss from Oppenheimer. And just I saw a screenshot of both of their characters and it was like a tweet saying this. It is so funny that these two drastically different characters are going to be up for the same award as it for the Oscars. But Ryan Gosling definitely is best supporting. Greta Gerwig, director, sure. Original screenplay, possibly. Hair and makeup, like art design, visual effects, yes, I think it's going to. I guess cinematography would be one of those as well. So it's going to be nominated for a good amount of awards. And it was a good movie. I always enjoy original movies. If you look at the movies that have been released this year, Mission Impossible was great, by the way. I didn't really get to talk about it on this podcast. I really enjoyed Mission Impossible. It made, like, no money, unfortunately. So the thing with this now is Barbie and Oppenheimer did not have crazy budgets. They had somewhere around $150-something million budgets, each of them. Less than $200 million, I should say, to be more specific. Because I don't know the exact numbers without looking it up. But less than $200 million budget for both of these movies. Oppenheimer had $100 million. I already looked it up. Oppenheimer had $100 million budget. And it's already made $180.4 million at the box office. And I think, I don't know if that's worldwide or domestic. But it was a lot. Barbie, I would imagine, had a little bit more of a budget just because it... Wow, my screen really lights up with glitter and everything like that. When you search Barbie, your entire thing turns pink. That's pretty cool. There it is again. Wow. So Barbie had a budget. This Wikipedia says it has a budget between $128 and $145 million. And this is definitely worldwide. So... Barbie box office, $382.3 million. Crazy amounts of money. And I actually saw a report, it was a headline of an article, that Oppenheimer made somewhere around $5 million because people who couldn't get, I don't know how they would conduct this statistic, but people who couldn't get Barbie tickets because it was sold out just saw Oppenheimer instead. And waited for Barbie tickets to become available, and then they would go see Barbie. So it was a huge weekend at the theater, and if you got to go to the theater at any, whether it was Thursday, Friday, Saturday, or Sunday night, you saw it was packed. Like, my theater was packed, and I have not seen it that crowded in a long, long time. People were dressed up in pink to go see Barbie, which I thought was incredible. I thought it's like so awesome, I think, when people dress up and they go to see the... go to the theater to see their favorite movies and their favorite characters and things that they're excited about. It's so great, and it's what movie theaters need. Because I'm an AMC A-lister. Like, I support it. I go to the movies often. Like, whenever I can. You know, I'll probably go to movies as early as next week to go see the new Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles movie. I'm very excited for that one, too. So there's a lot of films that I like to go and see. But Oppenheimer and Barbie both crushed it at the box office. Barbie, of course, is a huge, huge, huge social and generational name and doll and, like, toy and idea, which the idea of Barbie is really sold heavy in this movie from both sides, from, you know, the mom and her daughter from their side, how they have, especially the daughter, how she views Barbie, and then from Barbie's side of how she thinks she empowers women, where the daughter's like, you make little girls feel like shit about themselves because they don't look like you, blah 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 blah. like that kind of stereotypical argument that someone would have against Barbie. And then Barbie herself argues that, like, no, I'm supposed to empower women and then and show them that they can be a doctor or a cop or a lawyer or whatever it is. You can be those things. You don't, or president, whatever. You can be those things. And I'm here to show you that you can be, right? It's the two basic sides of the argument. But Barbie is such like a enormous worldwide brand that of course it's going to make a shit ton of money. Even if this movie wasn't good, it was going to make a lot of money. But we had the I guess blessing, the luck that Greta Gerwig made a good movie. Look at that. And she doesn't really make bad movies, so that's good. But Barbie was great. And of course, it made a lot of money. Oppenheimer was equally as great, I think slightly better of a movie. Christopher Nolan, also a guy, doesn't really miss, except for Tenet. I didn't like Tenet. Just is what it is. But I enjoyed both of these movies. Again, Oppenheimer is like a 9 out of 10, and Barbie's like an 8 out of 10. So really, really good stuff. Phenomenal performances, great writing, visually pleasing movies. Beginning to end. So just a phenomenal weekend for Barbenheimer. And as mentioned, the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles movie, I'm really excited for that. I'll do a review on that as well. But that will end it for this episode, from my point of view. It was a long one today, a lot to talk about, a lot happened this morning. But thank you all very much for listening. I appreciate you as always. Have a great rest of your week. Getting into August. By the next episode, next week, will be in August, which is like, where is the summer gone, man? This weather's been horrible. Just an L. L weather for this summer. All right, thank you all for listening, and I'll talk to you all next week. Doesn't seem to matter what I do. I'm always number two. No one knows how hard I try.